in this particular lesson. So there will be more people sort of filtering in here as we get going. If you're joining us online and you'd like to follow along with the notes here live while I teach this, you're going to want to go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down to under recent sermons, and you're going to want to click on the entry for June 11, and then you will be able to load and access the notes that we're going to be working off of here in class. So my plan is to teach this lesson and one more next week, and then we're going to be done kind of with this topic for the rest of the summer. I'm working on trying to fill out a calendar for other speakers. If I don't get enough, then I'll sort of fill in as needed, but we'll be talking about other things. So again, this is lesson 208, the AB 1611, Producing a Proper Perspective on the Preface, Leveraging Misuse, and Presentism. So let's get right into the introduction. In lesson 207, we concluded our apologetic analysis of Miles Smith's preface to the Authorized Version. After considering the work of Brother Christopher Yetzer and Catherine Ettenhuber, I am convinced that the primary function of Smith's famous preface was apologetic in nature. One of his main goals was to positively set forth a Protestant case for their view of church history, the scriptures in general, and the English Bible translation specifically. As such, it was intentionally designed to defend the Protestant view, considering Gregory Martin's preface to the Reims New Testament as a historical backdrop. Therefore, the King James preface needs to be understood in its proper historical context. It was written at a definitive point in time to address a circumscribed set of then contemporary factors. Consequently, modern attempts to leverage the preface to support 21st century views of text and translation are ahistorical and guilty of the historical error of presentism, i.e., the imposition of present-day values and assumptions on individuals and societies of the past. Now, I've been sort of beating that drum, sort of here and there over the last number of weeks, this idea of the misuse, leveraging, and presentism, okay? And we're going to be looking at that specifically this lesson and the next lesson next week as we think about closing down the class for the summer. So, the goal of this lesson is to shift our focus to the subject of contemporary use of the preface in terms of leveraging misuse and the historical era of presentism. In doing so, we'll address the following in this lesson. Number one, we're going to look at leveraging and misuse, personal thoughts and observations. We're going to look at some further thoughts from Brother Yetzer, and then we're going to look at the era of historical presentism as we work our way through this material this morning. Okay? So, let's get right into the first point. Leveraging and misuse, personal thoughts and observations. In preparation for this lesson, I asked a handful of people the following question. What do you believe are the biggest misuses of Miles Smith's preface on both sides of the text and translation debate? Let's stop there. I asked people on the King James side of this debate, and I asked people on the modern version side of this debate. So I did not want to only ask people that I thought would give me answers that I would find favorable. I wanted to ask people who might say things that I don't agree with. Okay. I asked more people the question than I have answers to because some did not answer me or declined or whatever to provide an answer. So I have in the notes like the main responses that I got to the question. Keep in mind, I asked more people than are noted here in this lesson, and they either declined or didn't respond for whatever reason. Please note that I intentionally asked a cross-section of people who take a variety of different positions related to text and translation. Some are modern version advocates, some are not. I wanted to get a diversity of opinions, lest I be accused of stacking the deck in favor of my own viewpoint. Moreover, I asked more people than responded. The following is a list of responses I received to the question. Okay, so again, the question I asked everybody is, what do you believe are the biggest misuses of Miles Smith's preface by those on both sides of the text and translation debate? That's the question I asked everybody. What we're going to look at now is a variety of answers. Okay, first, we're going to look at Timothy Berg's answer. Timothy Berg is a King James historian, but he is also a modern version advocate. So he is a former King James Onlyist. He has changed his mind for a variety of reasons, which I won't get into, but this was his answer to the question. He says, quote, "In my experience, the single biggest abuse by far is misusing the passage, quote, 'We have at length, through the good hand of the Lord upon us, brought the work to pass as you see it.' It is sometimes used to claim that the translators thought some kind of supernatural influence was upon them, through them, upon the King James Bible in some unique way, usually with the conclusion that they thought their work was error-free or inspired in some sense unique from other Bibles." So you can see he gave me a pretty long answer. Top page 2 is still his answer. "I have seen extremely intelligent men who I deeply respect make this mistake. It is not just wrong, it's absurd. It's so obviously an attempt to read one's own modern theology into the words of the preface in unhistorical ways. Of course, there is no way that this is what Smith meant. Certainly, not in any sense in which God's hand was upon the King James Bible, but not on other translations, or on the King James Bible more than other translations." So he's taking exception with those who would seize upon that statement. "We have at length, through the good hand of the Lord upon us, brought to work to pass as you see," to say that there was some sort of special spiritual hand of the Lord upon the translators to make them free of error. This is the main leveraging or misuse of the preface that Berg is identifying in his opinion. "Not only is this a blatant misread of the preface itself, where Smith makes extremely clear in relation to the LXX that he thinks translators are not prophets and never produce error-free or perfect work, and to blatantly misread the bibliology of the day, where no one ever thought this about an English translation, it is also to be extraordinarily ignorant of British history. The English had an incredibly high view of God's providence and of his working among them in particular. One only need look at the speech and sermon surrounding the destruction of the English Armada a few decades before the King James Bible, or the gunpowder plot during the King James period, to see the extremely high view of providence at work in the age. More than one massive monograph has traced out the English theology of providence at length. Every positive thing that happened in England was, quote, the good hand of God upon us. He providentially saved them from the Spanish and the Catholics and brought them money and gave them lands. Yes, they saw colonial expansion and the stealing of land from the world as God's gift of providence to them, and so on. The King James Bible, of course, as well, was produced in Smith's mind, and surely all the others, under the same guiding hand of providence." So what Berg is saying is that they viewed everything as God's what? If God, defeats the Spanish Armada, that's the providence of God. If God saves King James from the gunpowder plot to assassinate him, that's the providence of God. So every good thing that fell out to the favor of the English, they had a tendency to attribute it to God's providence. As a manner of belief back in those days. This is what Berg is getting at. "However, this has nothing to do with the claim that their work is perfect or inspired or somehow has a greater move of the Spirit on it or any such thing. Such claims are silly, but I see them all the time. In its most subtle form, people just quote Smith without explaining the historical background, hope readers will draw the conclusion of an inspired and almost inspired translation from it on their own. In a more insidious examples, they explicitly claim this and then cite Smith as supporting evidence. Both are misguided approaches which misread the preface. There are other examples of abuses of the preface, to be sure, including some which try too hard to make Smith sound like a modern translator or critic." Now, that's important, okay? Is he acknowledging that there are people on his side that will try to misuse this in the opposite direction? He is doing that. He just said, including some which try hard to make Smith sound like a modern translator or critic. "However, in my experience, this particular slip from this side is the most common and most egregious." Okay. Any questions or comments about Berg's answer to my question. So, in summation, he thinks that using that statement, again, what statement? The following. We have at length, through the good hand of the Lord upon us, brought the work to pass as you see it. Those who would use that quote to say that it's perfect or inerrant or what have you, he thinks is a misread. And then he gets into some history there related to providence in English history, etc. And then he does acknowledge at the end that there are people on the other side who read it and cite things and try to make the case that like Smith sound, makes Smith sound like a modern translator or a modern critic. Okay. So that was testimony number one. Testimony number two is Duane Green. Duane Green is the gentleman who I have been interviewed by three different times now on YouTube. Just this week, he interviewed me, by the way, about the subject matter of Easter in Acts 12:4. Duane Green is a Byzantine priority proponent as far as his position on the text, and he reads and uses a New King James Version in his church in Canada. Green said the following about my question, quote, "In a very general sense, I think people often use the preface to say the translators, quote, expected their Bible to be the standard English text, or that it decried the idea of King James Version onlyism." So he's also, not in as explicit terms as Berg, identifying that are there people on both sides that are using the preface to make different points in different directions, okay? Then I ask also Stephen Hayes. Stephen Hayes is a active commenter, supporter of the ministry on Facebook and social media, and I asked, and he's very knowledgeable on issues related to text and translation, and I asked him the question, and he said, quote, "On the majority text side of the house, two things come to mind. First, it is common that they use the preface to teach that the King James translators never believed their translation was perfect," which is interesting because Berg just basically made that point, okay? "Second, overused and misapplied is the quote, 'The very meanest translation of the Bible in English is the Word of God,' which they use as evidence that the King James translators would have approved of the many English translations we have today. This one might be their most common/egregious error. On the TR King James side, we have too often used it to say that since they believe their translation was to be the principal one and that it was perfect, that meant they believed it could never be updated. I think your recent studies have shown that was not the case." So again, is Brother Hayes, is I got that right, didn't I? Yeah, it's Brother Hayes identifying that there are ways that the preface is used on both directions, okay? Then I asked Nick Sayers. Nick Sayers is a TR King James advocate out of Australia, and I asked him the same question. He said, quote, "Definitely number one, the meanest translation relates to modern versions." So he's saying the number one misuse is the statement the meanest translation is it could be used to refer to or relate to modern versions. Saying that a variety of senses meaning, quote, alternative readings like the NKJV footnotes, when it just means like love or charity, not something totally left field. Also, not every marginal note is an alternative reading. So that's what he said. I asked my good friend Dave Reed the same question. He said, number one, misunderstanding of the, quote, perfect and better and one principle good one language. And second, the failure to understand choice not to use identity of phrasing. So it was their choice not to use identity of phrasing, he thinks is a major faux pas in terms of people understanding the preface. And then last, Christopher Yetzer, our brother from Italy, he says, regarding my question, he says, "I suppose I would say that no matter the quote pulled from it and who is using it, I think the biggest misuse on both sides are two things. Number one, not understanding the nature of the preface and its purpose in 1600s England and in book culture in general." Now, that's what I spent a whole lesson talking about last week, okay? And two, and I think this is an interesting point, acting as if all the translators were speaking in unison. Acting as if all the translators are speaking in unison. I am not saying that they would have all agreed, but I think there should be some effort made to consider whether they would have or not. So in other words, this is written by one guy, Miles Smith. Is it fair to say that Miles Smith spoke for all the translators all the time on every case? And Brother Yetzer would say, no, that's not, it's not fair to think that, and you need to do more digging, more research along those lines, as we're going to see here in a minute. So there's a survey of different opinions of people and how they responded to my question. So does anybody have any questions, comments, or reactions to point one? No? You didn't have anything, Mike? Looked like maybe you did a minute ago.
Smith, Smith was representing the whole group, but he was also speaking on his own terms. So I don't think anybody could say they represented the entire group in all their thoughts. So
you, in other words, you're kind of agreeing with what Yetzer is saying here, that to admit that you can't say that everything Smith said is representative of what all the translators thought about everything that's in there, which I think is a fair point. Okay. So with that in mind, then we want to sort of drill down a little bit deeper into the point that Brother Yetzer is making here. Okay. So that brings us then on page 3 to point number 2. Further thoughts from Brother Yetzer. Brother Yetzer elaborates on his second point extensively in his currently unpublished essay, The Very Vulgar. Yetzer addresses this point in part 3, The Preface Constrained, in which he discusses the extent to which Miles Smith represented the views/thinking of the other 50-plus translators. Quote, because the preface is the words of just one translator, it is not always known how well it represents all the translators or the historical truth in general. In order for one to claim, quote, the translators believed, in reference to the words in the preface, there should be some effort made in analyzing if the words might reasonably have been believed by all the translators, or if there is any external evidence to support the claim being made. So does everybody understand what he's saying? If you're going to say the translators believe, if you're going to make that statement and go to the preface because of what Miles Smith said, he's saying you need to really look at it a little bit more to see if that's justified, because maybe some of them would not have believed that. So he's addressing the idea of Smith speaking in unison for all of the translators. Okay, some of Smith's statements are upheld by separate witnesses, and others seem to be refuted by them, or at least show a toned-down version of them. Okay? And that's from pages 6 and 10. So, I don't know how to say this guy's name. Look at the next point. This Italian name? Diodati. Is that right?
That sounds right.
Diodati's English Annotations, a translation of the footnotes from his Italian Bible, and the English annotations written by a group of Englishmen, first printed in 1645, are used by Brother Yetzer as a historical case in point. Yetzer demonstrates by citing the prefaces of these different editions of annotations that one or more of them is not accurate in how they represent the nature of the work. Yetzer's main point in tracing this history in a paper about the King James Bible is as follows, quote, the point here is only to demonstrate that in the 17th century, the preface was a commercial product of publicity, and secondarily, that of the authors of them often had agendas and at points were errant or dishonest. Now, I don't take him, Brother Yetzer, to be accusing Miles Smith of being intentionally dishonest. What he's saying here is claims that are often made in the preface, you have to take with a grain of salt and compare them to other things that are made elsewhere to get to the bottom of whether or not they're correct. So top of page 4. Top of page 4. Therefore, Brother Yetzer cautions against viewing Miles Smith as speaking for all the translators in total. He offers the following statement from subsection 12, an answer to the imputations of our adversaries as a case in point. Quote, "For we have seen none of theirs of the whole Bible as yet." So that's a reference to the Catholic Bible. This statement seems to conflict with later statements made in subsection 15 regarding the Catholics' use of words like azymes, tunic, ratnel, holocaust, and pasch, with tunic and ratnel only occurring in the Douay Old Testament, which was published in two volumes in 1609-1610. How can Smith say in one place that the translators had never seen a whole Bible produced by Roman Catholics, and at the same time quote from the preface to the Douay Old Testament? Now, we've talked about this already, okay? We offer the following public explanation, or possible explanation, in Lesson 204. Quote, "In this statement from subsection 12, Smith seems to be saying that the translators, i.e. we, had not seen a Roman Catholic copy of the whole Bible as yet. Yet in subsection 15, Smith cites word usage choices from both the Old 1609 and 1610 and New 1582 New Testament of the Reims, Douay Reims Bible. How are we to reconcile these seemingly contradictory statements from the pen of Miles Smith? In my mind, the most charitable interpretation is to view Smith as speaking on behalf of all the translators in subsection 12, who indeed had not seen, quote, the whole Bible as yet, put forth by their Roman Catholic adversaries, since the Old Testament was not yet available when the bulk of the company work took place between 1604 and 1609. Whereas in subsection 15 of the preface, it is arguably written late in 1610 or early 1611, as the final preparations for the press were underway. Therefore, Smith in his person would have had the liberty to inspect the Douay Old Testament in its entirety before offering the preface. So Smith writing the preface late, has he had an opportunity to look at the Douay Old Testament? But the translating companies, when they were working on the Old Testament, did not have it available to them yet because it had not yet been what? Printed. Is everybody following that? Okay. So that's my example to kind of go along with what he's saying, with what Brother Yetzer's saying. With this example in mind, Brother Yetzer's caution not making every statement made by Smith at face value appears to have merit. Brother Yetzer provides examples of how historical corroboration helps sustain some of Smith's claims in the preface. Please consider the following examples. Okay, so now he gives examples of this. So let's make sure we understand what's going on here. One of his claims about misuse of the preface relates to people thinking that whatever Miles Smith said spoke was a statement that represented the views of who? All of them. Okay? Sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. And what Brother Yetzer is advocating for here is an extra step of historical corroboration, where if you're going to say the translators believed or said thus and so based on what Miles Smith said, you need to do more work to see if they would have actually agreed with that. Okay? And now we're going to look at an example of that that he gives. All right? So, example number one. Miles Smith in the King James Version preface stated, "Neither do we think much to consult the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, no, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or Dutch." Now, we've talked about that statement already. So this is the statement that he's talking about. So, in other words, was Miles Smith, when he said that, accurately speaking on behalf of the other translators, or is he making a private statement that is only true to him? All right. So, another next piece of evidence. The King James KJV dedication to King James. Quote, "For when your highness had once out of deep judgment apprehended how convenient it was that out of the original sacred tongues, together with the comparing of labors, both in our own and other foreign languages, of many worthy men who went before us, that there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue." So does the Epistle Dedicatory also mention the use of other language translations? Mm-hmm. Yes or no?
Other, but not all of those others.
Not all of the individuals, just a general statement. Other foreign languages.
German for sure.
Yeah. So we have the statement from the preface, and now do we have at least one little piece of corroboration? See everybody following that? Oxford, next point. Oxford Company translator George Abbott, in the reasons which Dr. Hill have brought for upholding a papistry, I think, 1604 quotes. This is from 1604. That is not in there is not in the world any fit means to come to the right sense of Scripture, which our men do not frequent. They seek into the original languages wherein the book of God was written. They confer translations of all sorts. They lay one text with another and expound the harder. By that which is less difficult, they compare circumstances of antecedents and consequence. They look to the analogy of faith prescribed in the creed of the apostles. They search what the first councils did establish. They seek what was the opinions of the fathers concerning texts in question, and refuse not therein to cope with you about the highest points. So here's another point. Are they searching everything according to what Abbott says here as they translate? You following that? Okay. Another Westminster Company translator, Roger Fenton, he said, quote, "We do with all diligence embrace those means which God hath provided for the interpretation thereof. Not only the rules of reason and human arts sanctified by God's grace in his faithful servants, but adding thereto also the record of antiquity, consent of fathers, testimony of learned men, conferring places, weighing circumstances, examining translations with such like, not singling any one means for the rest, as you fondly imagine, but joining them one together." So is Fenton describing a situation, again, where they're looking at all the available evidence? Okay. Second Cambridge Company translator, John Boyce, in his notes taken during the general meeting in London, he cites the Reims New Testament at Colossians chapter 2, verse 18, Latin at Romans 9, 6, and 1 Corinthians 9, 5, Old Interpreters at 1 Corinthians 11, 10, the Septuagint at 2 Timothy 2, 19, Italian at Revelation 7, 15, major number of translators at Hebrews 10, 12, and, quote, others is mentioned throughout. So in other words, do the notes of Boyce now demonstrate that they're actually using these other resources as they're doing their work, as Smith claimed in the preface? Okay. Secondhand testimony, John Selden, who was a friend of several translators, said, quote, "The translation in King James's time took an excellent way. The part of the Bible was given to him who was most excellent in such a tongue, as the Apocrypha to Andrew Downs." And they met together, and one read the translation, the rest holding in their hands some Bible, either of the learned tongues or French, Spanish, Italian. If they found any fault, they spoke. If not, he read on. So now do we have secondhand testimony that they're conferring with the French, the Spanish, the Italian, as well as the original sacred tongues? So the point here is this. What Yetzer is doing is he's building a cumulative case to say that when Miles Smith uttered that one statement, was he in fact speaking for all of them when he made that statement? Remember the original statement he made? About neither did we think much to consult the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or Dutch. So when he said that in the preface, was he accurately representing what all the translators did? Is the point. Okay? Then he gives a textual analysis. Comparing the text itself is difficult because of the number of possible sources consulted and the fact that Those sources commonly agree with one another. Here are some possible examples. Genesis 23:6, most translations have something like Prince of God, but the King James translated as Mighty Prince, similar to the 1588 Pastors and Professors of Geneva French Bible, which read Prince Excellent. Genesis 37:36, most of the previous English translations have Chief Steward or something similar, but the King James has Captain of the Guard, similar to the Reina 1569 Spanish Bible, which read Captain de los LaGuardia, which I'm assuming means something similar to Captain of the Guard. Hebrews 11:28, most English translations have effusion, right? But the King James uses sprinkling, similar to Dionysius 1607 Italian. And then we have Matthew 9:4. Most established translations had seeing, but the King James uses knowing, possibly following a quote from Chrysostom. 2 Corinthians 2:10. Most English translations had in the sight, but the King James uses in the person, like in the 1582 Reims. 1 Corinthians 7:35, most English Bibles had separation, but the King James uses distraction, like Beza's Latin translations, etc. So, what Yetzer's point here is to say that if you're going to say that the translators believed based upon a statement in the preface, you have to be able to demonstrate that a preponderance of them actually what? Did believe that statement. Okay? Is everybody following that? Here's another one. Example 2. Another example from the preface that has outside agreement is the following statement. Miles Smith in the preface. Another thing we think good to admonish thee of, gentle reader, is that we have not tied ourselves to an uniformity of phrasing or to an identity of words. KJV translator Daniel Featley in Transubstantiation Exploded, did I read that right? Transubstantiation Exploded, 1638, said the following: the same word in diverse places of Scripture may be diversely taken according to the diversity of the matter and the circumstances of the text. So is he affirming that they didn't use, that it's okay to not use uniformity of phrasing or identity of words? Okay. Then you got a textual analysis here. I'll probably skip most of this because it's technical, but there's different examples that you can give, and we've already given some. I gave one on Thursday. Remember the one I gave a few weeks ago about the lilies of the field, they toil not, neither do they spin, versus the lilies of the field, they spin not, they toil not, or something, they toil not, they spin not, and how we talked about how the Greek in those two verses is exactly the same, but then they're rendered slightly differently into English and not using the exact same words. That's the concept that we're after here, okay? So, after providing the above examples, Brother Yetzer states the following quote. While some of the preface is substantiated by other sources, it is not true that every word of the preface accurately or universally represented the opinions of all the translators. Even though Smith's intention was certainly to do so, as much as his agenda would permit, King James Version researcher Timothy Berg, in talking about the section of the King James preface titled A Satisfaction to Our Brethren, has noted that Smith's, quote, rebuttal of Puritan objections to the project, for example, could hardly be said to reflect the thinking of, say, John Reynolds. Newman and Hauser, a source I cited, by the way, in an earlier lesson, Newman and Hauser pointed out that their co-author's work made clear that, quote, King James knew why he wanted another translation, though his motivations may not have exactly paralleled those articulated in the translators to the reader. So in other words, James knew why he wanted another Bible, But that's not necessarily what Smith's conveying in the preface. Okay? Clearly, not all the translators could have ratified the final draft of the preface, given that a few of them had died since before Smith began the first draft. Besides that, there seems to be some evidence that at least a few of the translators might have disagreed with some of the wording in the preface, or at least in their writings, they worded things with less embellishment. Okay? KJV researcher Timothy Berg has surmised, quote, "I think it is wise to speak of the preface as having a sole author, Miles Smith, who was commanded to write, quote, in the names of all the translators," to quote from the editor of his 1632 collection of sermons. This can help us fruitfully dialogue without the, to my mind, unwarranted claims that all the translators either agreed perfectly with Smith at every point or disagreed with him in unison on any point. Okay? Any questions? So, the bottom line here on this point is this. What Smith writes, is he trying to represent the views of between 47 and 52 guys? Sometimes he hits the nail on the head. Other times, some people might have agreed with the idea but would have said it in a less sort of rhetorical way. Other times, there might have been places where some of the translators just flat out wouldn't have agreed with the way he said it. Okay? Does anybody have any questions about that? Now, I have to give Brother Yetzer major props here, because he did a lot of work on this, and he's only provided two examples. There's a third example that he provides in the essay, but it doesn't really fit what we're talking about. It's a little bit of a different situation. But he has definitely done a lot of work, good work on this to prove this point. All right. So before we move on to the last point in this lesson, does anybody have any questions or comments? Alright, so the error of historical presentism. I mentioned this a couple different times. Douglas L. Wilson is the author of an essay titled Thomas Jefferson and the Meaning of Liberty. The piece originally appeared in the November 1992 issue of The Atlantic. Among other things, the piece covers the historical error of presentism, i.e., the imposition of present-day values and assumptions on individuals and societies of the past. In the following excerpt, Wilson applies the era of presentism to Thomas Jefferson and the era of American founding. Okay, now, is American history right now a political hot potato?
Yes.
Yes, okay, you have hardcore right-wing Christians who think that everything about the American founding was absolutely the work of God. You know, Jonathan Edwards, the shining city on the hill type of idea, and they think that everything, it was all the providential and work of God. Okay, but then you have leftist historians who all they want to do is castigate and denigrate and down and run down the founding fathers as all being racist, homophobic bigots who were just terrible humans, et cetera, okay? So you understand that history has become very political given what's going on in our day. What presentism is it's the idea that it is not fair to read present sensibilities, understandings, cultural views on people of a different historical era of the past. That is what presentism is about. And so the author of this essay, Thomas Jefferson and the Meaning of Liberty, Doug Wilson, he's addressing this problem, and he's using Thomas Jefferson and the American founding as a example. Okay, so let's look at the first quote. In this selection, a distinguished Jefferson scholar reflects on this, quote, many-sided and multi-talented man, especially on his contradictions concerning slavery and race. In doing so, Douglas Wilson raises a crucial point about the perils of presentism. That is, of intruding today's values and attitudes upon the past. To do that, he warns, is distorting history. What annoys him is that too many Americans today seem unable to discuss the past in its own terms. Unable to, quote, make appropriate allowances for prevailing historical conditions. If you read Jefferson, Jefferson is a very troubled soul on the matter of liberty, freedom, and slavery. Okay? He knows that there's a contradiction between what he's argued regarding American liberty and freedom and owning slaves. He knows it. For whatever reasons, he does not free his slaves while he is alive. Okay? And so what happens now in discussions of Thomas Jefferson is present-day understandings of race and these concepts, now they get read back and hung onto Jefferson instead of just trying to understand Jefferson on Jeffersonian terms. Okay? Now, I'm not excusing anything Jefferson did or didn't do. That's not the point of this. I'm trying to get you to think about it from a historical framework. What Doug Wilson is saying, I'll read it again. What annoys him is that too many Americans today seem unable to discuss the past in its own terms. This is what we call in history contextualization. And understanding the actual historical context as it existed at the time. Okay? Any questions about that? So what's happening, just to finish that line again, what annoys him is that too many Americans today seem unable to discuss the past in its own terms, unable to, quote, make appropriate allowances for the prevailing historical conditions. Now, why am I quoting this here? I'm quoting this here because I am submitting to you that this is exactly what is happening with discussion of the King James Preface. People are entering into a conversation about the preface and they bring with them modern text critical methodologies and thinking about the Bible, and they bring it all with them into a conversation about something that happened more than 400 years ago, and they use the preface now to try, and they try to read all their current understanding back into the preface. That's presentism. That is not a good approach. Is everybody following that? So let's look at the next quote, where he kind of explains the term a little bit more. Presentism is the term that historians use for applying contemporary or otherwise inappropriate standards to the past. Okay? An awkward term at best, it nevertheless names a malaise that currently plagues American discussions of anything and everything concerning the past. The widespread inability to make appropriate allowances for the prevailing historical conditions. Is everybody following that? Now, you say, well, so this is why I spent two lessons talking about an apologetic analysis of the preface and saying you cannot understand the preface if you don't understand it within the framework of the Martin Fulk controversy that was raging between Catholics and Protestants at the end of the 1500s, moving into the 1600s. That's the context. Okay? They didn't know anything about the critical text. They didn't know anything about, the papyri. They didn't know anything about all this stuff now that modern text critics talk about. Okay? So to take modern theory and practice and put it back on them and say, see, they would have supported what we're doing, is absurd to me. Okay? So let's go on with the quote. The issue of presentism is hardly new, but it has perhaps been amplified of late by the debunking and revisionist spirit of the times and the effort this has had on public perceptions. As the uncritically positive an unabashedly patriotic approach that for so long characterized the teaching of American history in the public schools has abated. Now let's stop there, okay? Some people aren't going to disagree with this, but do we have to be realistic about also the founding from this point of view? Was everything they did wholly moral and acceptable biblically?
No.
So there's a ditch on the other side. The ditch on the other side is to overlook the mistakes that they made and you know, turn them all into icons of virtue in ways that and not be real and honest with what they actually did. Okay, that's one ditch. And that was the ditch now that had dominated maybe a lot of American history teaching for a long time. But now the pendulum has swung to the ditch on the other side. And the ditch on the other side is to judge them all based upon modern what? Modern sensibilities and ways of thinking. Okay, so let's read that sentence again. As the uncritically positive and unabashedly patriotic approach that for so long characterized the teaching of American history in the public schools has abated. Now watch. The emphasis has steadily shifted to the problems and failures of the past. The saga of the glories of the Old West thus has given way to a saga of exploitation and greed. The pride in the conquering of the wilderness has yielded to the shame of despoiling the land and dispossessing the indigenous peoples. What seems to have happened is that a laudably corrective trend has predominated to such an extent that the emphasis seems somewhat reversed, and parents complain that they scarcely recognize the history their children are what? So in other words, you've got one extreme and you've got another what? Extreme. The truth of the situation is more where? In the middle. Okay? So Wilson is writing this to talk about American history, but I'm saying that this phenomenon of presentism is rife within discussion of the King James preface. Okay. Now, any questions or comments about that? Look, the founding of this country was, I've said this before and no one has assassinated me yet, but the founding of this country was a combination of, yes, Judeo-Christian ethics and values about morality, with Enlightenment philosophy about government and how governments work. Okay? When Thomas Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence and he talks about natural rights, he's using John Locke's natural rights philosophy to justify why America should break away from Great Britain. When the founders and framers of the Constitution separate the powers of the government and they divide powers and they do all this stuff, they're adopting Enlightenment thinking about government. And how government should work. So it's a combination. It's not wholly one or wholly the other. It's both. And what ends up happening is a lot of people, they want to focus on just one thing, and they therefore miss what I would say is the real story. Now, what's happening in modern conversations of the preface is I'm arguing the same thing. People are taking present standard and reading it back in there and saying, "See, they would have agreed with us." Okay. Now, I think both sides do it, but let's look at my last points here. It is my contention that presentism clouds modern readers from properly contextualizing the preface to the King James Bible. As a result, modern standards and praxis regarding textual criticism and modern version advocacy are imposed upon the preface in an ahistorical manner. This is done by contemporary interlocutors who seek to rhetorically leverage the preface and advance the argument that the King James translators would have agreed with them. Okay? I think parties on both sides of the text and translation debate do this to varying degrees. I'm going to suggest to you that, in my observation, the modern critical text side is... the degree to which they do it is much greater. I'll just say it that way. Okay? Now, in the next lesson then, we will consider Joshua Barzan's 2022 book, The Forgotten Preface, as an example of presentism when it comes to the preface. All right? Now, does anybody have any questions or comments about anything I've said in this lesson about leverage, misuse, and presentism? You look like you have something you want to say, Mike.
I just wonder how many people have actually read the preface, since it hasn't been present in any Bible for so long. I mean, certain pastors and researchers like yourself have read it, and we have read it now, but most people who read their family Bible don't know anything about the preface.
That's true. Yeah. And the other danger is, and I'm going to point this out next week when we look at Brother Barzan's book, is that he presents the preface in a modern form that has been way edited even further than what I presented. So you remember how I would give you the parallel columns? You had the modern spelling, and then you had the original preface in modern spelling, and then you had the modern form. Nothing I read in that modern form I felt was way off base from anything that Miles Smith said. I think that is not the case when we look at what Barzan is going to have to say and how he quotes and uses the preface. Because he's already editing it to make it fit with what he wants to say before he even goes about explaining it. And I'll show you that. I'll prove that to you next week. It's not even a debatable issue in my mind. Okay? Any other thoughts or comments? So, we've been at the preface now since the first Sunday in February. So, we'll finish it next Sunday. If there are no questions or comments, I appreciate everybody's attention, and we'll get the last lesson on this next week, and we're going to look at the book, The Forgotten Preface by Joshua Barzan, and we're going to look at it within the framework of presentism in this discussion. Okay? So if there's no questions, we can be done a few minutes early. Appreciate everybody's attention. Thanks for coming out.